This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. There's been a lot of attention over the last few years to the risks of repeated head injuries for athletes in contact sports. One big worry is chronic traumatic encephalopathy, called CTE for short. It's a potentially fatal degenerative brain disease found in people who experience repeated head trauma. As research on the disease has developed, it's become a major concern for professional-level contact sport athletes, including former Badger linebacker and briefly NFL player Chris Borland. Here he is in a PSA for the Union of Concerned Scientists.
My name is Chris Borland. I walked away from pro football and a $2.9 million contract with the San Francisco 49ers because I didn't want to develop CTE, or chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is caused by repeated brain injury. Researchers at Boston University studied the brains of 111 deceased NFL players. They found CTE in 110. CTE is a brain disease that causes depression, aggression, dementia, and in some cases, suicide. Yet for many years, the NFL denied the link.
A more recent study from Boston University published last fall found that even athletes at the youth level could be at risk of CTE. Our next guest is a Wisconsin expert on brain injuries in youth sports. She joins us now to weigh the risks of head injury with the benefits of youth sport participation. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have kids who play contact sports like football? How early did they start? Have you taken any extra precautions to prevent head injuries and brain damage? Have you pulled your kids out of contact sports over those concerns? Did you grow up playing one of these sports? Do you look back and worry about what could have been? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Julie Stamm is a clinical assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology at UW-Madison. She's the author of the book, The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, The Myths, and The Future. Julie, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
First of all, Julie, can you give us a brief reminder of what CTE is, its causes, and what it does to people?
Yeah, CTE is a neurodegenerative disease, kind of similar to Alzheimer's disease or other neurodegenerative diseases you might have heard of. This disease in particular affects people who have been exposed to repetitive brain trauma. This is not just concussions. Concussions can be part of that trauma, but it's been diagnosed in people who have not had a history of concussions, at least diagnosed concussions. So it's just that repetitive brain trauma happening over and over and over again for years that we know is a risk factor for this disease. And it is affecting many parts of the brain, and as a result can have many symptoms, including, as you heard in the clip, aggression, impulsivity, difficulty controlling behaviors, memory difficulties and depression, mood difficulties as well. So it's a variety of different symptoms associated with it.
One difficulty in understanding the scope of the disease is, and correct me if I'm wrong, Julie, the only diagnosis is in an autopsy, unfortunately. We don't really have a system for diagnosing this in somebody who's still alive.
That's correct. Right now, we can only diagnose the disease after someone has passed away. And that's a huge limitation, not only for the patients, but also for research and furthering our understanding of the disease. Right now, we can't see it during life, in part because it doesn't look much different on a traditional MRI than Alzheimer's disease, for example. It looks very similar. There's a lot of research going into that, but we really need to figure out how to diagnose it during life.
One thing that makes complicated is to know how widespread it is. We hear the statistics from the Boston University studies, X percent of brains of these deceased athletes. You pointed out elsewhere, this is a skewed sample in some ways. We shouldn't necessarily panic and say, 40% or 100% or whatever of athletes will have CTE. Do I have that right?
Yes, absolutely. And that's a really important point. The studies that they're doing are trying to describe what the disease looks like in people who have it. And as part of that research, you report the number of people that you looked at that have the disease and those who don't. But it's a very biased sample. People don't tend to think to donate their brains to a brain bank like that unless they think that something's wrong. So you're more likely to find the disease in a brain bank sample like that. So the 110 out of 111 NFL players, for example, that does not mean that 99% of NFL players have the disease. It's just what they found in their sample. We really don't know how prevalent it is at this time because we can't diagnose it during life.
Now, another concern here is, you know, well, okay, NFL players, maybe they've played since they were 10 or younger, through high school, through college, through an NFL career. Boston University researchers have also looked now at some younger athletes, again, people who had symptoms that might have pointed towards CTE, and found that, yes, in fact, younger people can show this this abnormal brain development from CTE.
Yes, and this is such an important point because I think for a long time, CTE was thought to be a disease of professional athletes. You had to play for 20 years or 10 years in the NFL to get the disease. And we know that's not the case. The recent study looked only at individuals under age 30, and the vast majority of them, 70% or more, were amateur athletes. And many of those only played through high school. So this is telling us that for some people, they may be at risk, even if they don't go on to play years in the NFL or even go on to play college.
Talking to Julie Stamm from the Department of Kinesiology at UW-Madison, author of the book, The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, The Myths, and the Future. We're looking at repetitive brain injury for athletes, the impact it can have over time, CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy, and other potential outcomes, and how we evaluate those risks in our decisions as athletes or parents of athletes. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Julie, people will react to this kind of news in different ways. Some might say, okay, my kid's never going to play this kind of sport. Some might say, whatever. Where do you come down in terms of advice on how we manage contact sports, given what we know and are still learning about the impact of brain injuries?
Well, as we said, we don't know how prevalent this disease is. And we do know that sports have a lot of benefits. Every kid should have the opportunity to play sports, so we shouldn't be getting rid of sports. We can modify them to make these sports safer and eliminate and minimize repetitive brain trauma in sport. For the people in this study of younger athletes, younger individuals who had CTE, those who had CTE had more overall years of play, and that's been consistent across the research. More total impacts over time equals greater risk. So when we start playing young, not only are we potentially disrupting all of the brain development that's happening, but we're also accumulating more hits over time. So we can delay the start of those impacts until we're a bit older. My preference would be high school, but at least until middle school. Then we're minimizing or reducing the overall career impacts we have. And then minimizing as much as possible those impacts when we do get to the high school level, and if you're good enough to go on to the college level. Most people are just going to play through high school, so they'll have 4 years in that case if they delay contact until high school, and then maybe we don't hit at all or hit very, very little in practice. There are many championship teams across the country who don't hit at all, some coached by NFL players as well. And if we do that, we're minimizing our total career impacts, which really decreases the risk for developing CTE.
Let's bring on a caller. Paul is with us in Summit. Paul, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Great show. I was a wrestling coach. I've had 6 concussions myself. I've been in the combative arts for 10 years and no longer in it. And also a public school teacher. And, you know, we want kids to get the benefits of athletic competition and to be able to all the benefits from that. But at what point do we have a serious conversation at the high school and actually the middle school and the elementary level where we're exposing these kids to sports that we know is going to have lasting negative impacts on their health? You know, at what point are we going to, as a society, say enough is enough? I hate to be the one that squelches their fun, right?
Mm-hmm.
And all the benefits. But thanks for the great show.
Oh, Paul, before you go, I want to ask about your sport of choice over the years, wrestling. And when do you think kids should start? What would ballpark, where would you draw the line?
I have 2 boys, one's in 8th grade, one's in 9th grade. And let them play, one play sports. And my wife has said she's in healthcare. She has said no contact sports, but obviously baseball and basketball still have contact. But I think that at the elementary level, we're having kids play, football at the elementary level. And I think that the brain isn't developed fully. I think that I've seen kids get concussions. I've had kids on my wrestling team get concussions. And so I would say that we're going to have to talk about, you know, the whole sports experience from elementary, middle to high school.
Paul, thanks a lot for that call. Paul gave us a lot to work with, Julie. Jump on whatever you want from what he had to share.
Yeah, I think there was a lot to work with there, as you said. I really agree that delaying that start of contact, and it's not just contact, it's the sports where you're repetitively hitting your head, right? So football gets a lot of attention, but ice hockey, soccer, rugby, wrestling as well. I think there are ways to play these sports without the repetitive brain trauma. Flag football, hockey has eliminated checking before age 13 and before age 15 in some leagues as well. And they've had great success with that. Heading is limited in soccer for young individuals. You can play flag rugby too. So playing versions of these sports where we're not hitting our head repeatedly. We will never prevent every concussion, but we can prevent those repetitive impacts that can lead to this disease, regardless of whether or not you have a concussion. And of course, we also need to treat these concussions appropriately, identify them, manage them, and make sure that we're being extra conservative with kids who, as our caller said, the brain is still developing. So we really want to protect that.
Thanks so much for that call. We're talking to Julie Stamm, clinical assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology at UW-Madison, author of the book, The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, The Myths, and The Future. We're talking about the most recent research on repeated brain injuries for young athletes, especially in contact sports, the risk of CTE and other conditions. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Has this been a story in your life? Have your loved one been in one of these sports and maybe felt some of these consequences or been worried about it? How are you managing these issues for your own family, your own team? If you're a coach, maybe at a school or a club, join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with Julie Stamm, clinical assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology at UW-Madison, author of the book, The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, The Myths, and The Future. We're talking about the risks of repeated brain injuries and impacts in younger athletes in particular, recent research on how early we could see the effects of CTE, a degenerative brain disease. Still time for your calls, your thoughts, questions, or maybe your own experiences at 800-642-1234. Have concerns about brain damage impacted choices about what sports to participate in for you or your kids? Or in hindsight, do you wish they had? Are you with some sort of sports organization that is maybe changing the rules, changing age guidelines for certain behaviors, heading, tackling, and more? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Julie, we're focusing mostly on CTE, but you've pointed out in your book and elsewhere, that's not the only potential risk of repeated head impacts. What other concerns are out there?
That's true. With kids, the brain is rapidly developing, and there is research that I've done and my colleagues have done that suggests that we may be disrupting some of those processes while we hit our head repeatedly as kids. So that's one thing that's very important, is we really want to have our kids have the best possible brain development they can have and gain all of the skills and make all of the connections in the brain that they can when they're young. So that's something that we want to protect as well. We also know that some of the symptoms of CTE can also happen even when CTE is not there. So things like depression and other psychiatric disorders, for example, have been increasingly linked recently to repetitive brain trauma and to concussions, and that's separate from the disease. So that's another concern that we have, that You know, even in this study that we've been talking about, almost everyone had symptoms, but not everyone had CTE. On the good side, these symptoms can be treated. So even if you're experiencing depression, for example, and you played high school football, it does not mean you have CTE. Odds are you probably don't. But that's a symptom that can be treated. And it could be linked to the brain trauma, but again, it can be treated. So that's another concern that's growing in the research community regarding brain trauma in sport.
Right. I wanted to bring that up. Treatment, again, we don't know if any particular person has CTE, but is there enough awareness among athletes of and their parents of signs of depression or other behavioral changes where they should maybe sit up and take notice, reach out and see what kind of help is available?
Definitely reach out and seek help, because you know it's very likely that it's not CTE, especially if you've played only through high school. I think we have to be aware that it could be. It's possible that it could be, because the research shows us that it could be. But it seems more likely that that risk is relatively low, especially if you have only played only through high school. We know it's not zero though. But regardless, if you are having these symptoms, do reach out to a healthcare provider. There are treatments for depression and anxiety and apathy and many of these symptoms. And again, it may not be related to CTE. And if it is, we can't treat CTE at this time because we don't know how to even diagnose it, but we can treat these symptoms.
Let's bring on another caller now. Bill is with us in Arcadia. Bill, hi.
Hi. Yes, I just wanted to comment that wrestling has changed some of the rules to protect from concussion.
What kind of changes have you seen, Bill?
Well, there's something called a two-on-one that where if you're grasping the other person standing up, see if I can describe this so you can understand. But if we're both standing up and I'm behind you and I grab your bicep basically and your wrist, and the typical finish to that was to take you to the side where the elbow was controlled so you didn't have that ability to catch yourself.
Ah.
And that is now illegal.
Because I probably hit my head in that instance.
Exactly. Exactly.
Bill, thanks a lot for that call. Now, Julie, I imagine you talk to people in the sports world a lot, and I don't know, I feel like in the old days, whenever that was, there'd be a lot of resistance to rules changes like no checking in hockey or outlawing certain maneuvers in wrestling and things like that. Are you seeing the youth sports world open up to these changes more?
Yes, we definitely are, which is great. Different leagues and different sports have had more or fewer changes that have been made. It's great to hear about that change in wrestling to protect the head. The change with delaying the start of checking has been very successful. Not only have they seen a reduction in concussions, but also in overall injuries in hockey as a result of that rule. There's less research that's gone into soccer so far. Football's been somewhat mixed. So reducing practice time related to contact has been helpful in some cases. It has, in general, decrease the number of concussions and impacts that occur in practice, although games are still the same, but that is still overall reduction since we spend more time in practice, especially. But it is really coach specific as well. And I think that's an important point, take home point for any coaches or parents listening too, that the culture is very, very important. Some studies have shown that even if the amount of time dedicated to contact has been reduced, some coaches just try to fit all of that contact into such a short amount of time that they actually end up hitting more in practice and have more injuries. So it's really taking that health of your athlete, whether that's your child or whether that's your athletes, if you're a coach, really taking that health to heart and prioritizing that and minimizing impacts, using drills and other techniques and practice time to get the skills across without the impacts.
Bill, thanks a lot for sharing that rule change. Julie, I know you've mentioned CTE. It isn't a story just about concussions. It can be what I think are called subconcussive impacts. That said, I feel like I'm seeing a lot more attention to concussions themselves at the highest levels of the sports world. are we seeing better treatment, better handling when that athlete does, that young athlete does have what appears to be a concussion?
I think we are. I think we've made big strides in the last decade plus. There have been a lot of changes in the last decade. For example, we used to say, lock yourself in a dark room if you have a concussion. And now we know that exercise can actually be helpful. The initial recommendation was based on logic, right? If your symptoms become worse when you exercise your brain or exercise your body, don't do it. But now we know that it's okay if they get a little bit worse, but the exercise is within limits. Limited exercise is helpful for your brain and healing. So that's just one change that we have done that has really improved outcomes. And I think we're doing a better job of recognizing concussions. It's still really difficult. You know, we still see cases in the NFL that go undiagnosed, at least initially. And they have so many medical providers and spotters in the booth. And at a youth football game, you might just have a coach. So it's still difficult. And athletes have to tell us about their symptoms oftentimes. So we still have a long ways to go, but there have been good strides that have been made.
Julie, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Julie Stamm, clinical assistant professor in the Department of Kinesiology at UW-Madison, author of the book, The Brain on Youth Sports, The Science, The Myths, and The Future. She joins to talk about CTE, chronic traumatic encephalopathy. That's a chronic brain injury, and what recent research says about the risks facing young athletes in contact sports and how to weigh those risks as athletes, as parents, as coaches. Still time for you to share your thoughts on this or share your story or maybe a rule change you've seen in whatever sport you or your youth are involved in. You could do that a couple ways. You could email ideas@WPR.org or you can post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show, Wisconsin's voting maps need to change after a ruling from the state Supreme Court. What is that going to mean? A Wisconsin researcher tells us what it takes to make a new map and what could change in the world of state politics. As always, you can weigh in with your thoughts, your hopes for the outcome, and your questions for The Morning Show guest. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Yesterday on the show, we invited you to call in and share your favorite hobbies. A lot of you called in during the show. We heard from some more of you on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here's a couple. Stacy writes, I wish pigeon racing would make a comeback. Unfortunately, most of the people in the hobby are elderly and passing on. Stacy says, pigeons are wonderful little characters who can be pretty friendly if you spend the time with them. And Nick tells us, my favorite hobby is painting miniatures for display and for tabletop games like D&D. And Nick shared some pictures of his handiwork with us. Speaking of pictures, Dick from Darlington had called in yesterday to tell us about his hobby of collecting rolls of duct tape from around the country, around the world, and beyond, including duct tape from the International Space Station. After the show, he sent us some pictures of that collection, how it's organized, the orbital duct tape, and a roll from Antarctica. He's gotten duct tape, he says, from 92 countries. He's got a list of the rest that he still wants tape from. Still time to share your hobby. Email ideas@WPR.org or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talked to a researcher who's found a genetic link for severe nausea and vomiting during pregnancy. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a story about a chilly outing in Milwaukee that took place more than a century ago.
People do a lot to make the best of Wisconsin's brutal winters. Some strap on snowshoes or hit the sledding hills. The extremists participate in polar plunges. As Milwaukee historian and author John Gerda reminds us, the winter thrill seekers have been thriving in the area for a long time.
Were our ancestors really hardier than we are? Were they better equipped to weather Wisconsin's winters? One story says they were. On New Year's Day in 1895, 10 young men took the Milwaukee River from North Avenue all the way to Thienesville, a distance of 18 miles on ice skates. One of them, Joseph Bell, left a chronicle of the adventure and its warm reading on a cold winter's day. Wearing knickerbockers, thick sweaters, and strap-on skates, the group left Milwaukee at 10 in the morning. Many skaters were upon the ice for the first few miles north, wrote Bell, but we had only to climb over the first weir of frozen waterfalls where the dull roar of the under-cataract sounded solemn and uncanny to leave behind all these ephemeral merrymakers and the last view of the city. That cataract would have been in today's Estabrook Park. The real fun started once they had the river to themselves. But the skating, Bell enthused, such skating as it was, such ice and such a winter's day, as one might wait an entire season for to see. Not a stirring of the air, save that we made ourselves as we rushed along the smooth black surface. The skaters were on uncharted ice with plenty of hazards ahead. Their leader plunged into waist-deep water at the first flour mill, and Bell himself belly-flopped through what he called a 2-inch layer of slush water spread over a surface of sunken ice. But there were pleasant surprises as well. In shallow parts of the midstream, he recalled, we could see the fishes through ice clear as window glass. The Milwaukeeans reached Thiensville in 3 hours and 40 minutes, traveling at an average speed of 5 miles an hour. The pot of gold at the end of their rainbow was a prearranged royal good dinner of turkey and goose at Memler's Inn, a German place on the river. The skaters, Bell reported, were famished. I am afraid the smiling folk who gazed at us through the sliding panel from the kitchen must have wondered if we had ever had a square meal in our lives. In half an hour, the table looked as if a typhoon had struck it amidships. After a full meal and a few drinks, most of the travelers took the train back to the city. Not Joseph Bell and two of his hardier companions. Even though night was falling, they decided to skate home by moonlight. And that, according to Bell, was the best part of the journey. On we sped at ever-increasing pace until we had reached the limit for safety, and only tempering our speed when crackling surface ice and an opaque appearance of the river ahead warned us of rapids underneath and ticklish skating above. Despite their best efforts to read the river, the skaters experienced several somersaults, wrote Bell, and one of them plunged into a waterhole 2 feet deep. The trio reached the North Avenue Bridge at the stroke of 8, with their clothing frozen hard and clanking like steel armor. Bell still faced a long streetcar ride home to the west side, but he had no regrets. Truly, it was entrancing, that return trip, and romantically beautiful. By far the most conspicuous recollection that remains to me of the entire outing. You don't have to skate to Thiensville and back, but Joseph Bell's chronicle is a welcome reminder of winter's unique potential for fun. Bell and his buddies had the right idea. Unplug, they might tell their modern-day descendants, turn off those tyrannical screens. Get outside and enjoy winter like genuine four-season Wisconsinites.
John Gerda is a Milwaukee-born author and historian. He's written 23 books on the history of the city. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lola and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
You're listening to Central Time. Morning sickness is a fairly common condition during pregnancy, but a more severe condition is a risk coming up in about 2% of pregnancies. It's called hyperemesis gravidarum, or HG. Unlike normal morning sickness, hyperemesis is severe, debilitating, and can last a lot longer than the first trimester of pregnancy. Untreated, it can lead to serious pregnancy complications, even death. New research has found a link between a variant in a gene for a hormone that causes nausea and vomiting, and maybe a roadmap to potential cures. We're talking about this kind of severe, debilitating nausea and vomiting during pregnancy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Have you dealt with this hyperemesis gravidarum? Did your doctors dismiss you, or at first maybe? Were you able to receive help? How did that condition affect your pregnancy, your well-being? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Marlena Fazo is a medical scientist behind the new research on hyperemesis gravidarum. She's a clinical assistant professor of population and public health sciences in the Center for Genetic Epidemiology at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. Marlena, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Your research into the causes and potential cures for this condition, obviously of interest, but it was in part inspired, I understand, by your own personal experience with this condition. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, so I had very severe hyperemesis gravidarum, where it was so bad that I could not eat, drink, or move without violently vomiting. This went on for weeks, and eventually my doctor put me on 7 different medications at once, but nothing allowed me to be able to eat. And so I was put on a feeding tube, but it was too late, and eventually I lost the baby in the second trimester. I am a scientist. I was already focused on women's health research. So I decided to look into what was known about it after that, and decided to dedicate my life to figuring out what caused it, since there was really next to nothing known about it and a lot of incorrect myths that I knew had to be wrong.
Right. Before we get into your findings, it really struck me. This is about 2% of pregnancies, obviously a very serious condition. I would think it would be an easy sell to get research funding, to get your department heads to get on board with this. No, the people didn't seem to be eager to even pursue research on this. Can you talk about what you had to overcome and where you ultimately went to get some research findings?
Yeah, so there's very little research in conditions of women, conditions of pregnancy. I think it's mostly because of the thalidomide tragedy, where in the 1950s, people were given thalidomide to treat their nausea and vomiting of pregnancy. And unfortunately, the babies were born with limb deformities. And so that really put a stop to research into this condition. And in addition to that, it was this myth that people with HG, that something psychological was going on, that still happens to be taught today, that people don't really want their babies, and ridiculous theories like that that have been perpetuated and are still perpetuated to this day. So I hope this study puts an end to that. But yeah, so I tried to get the research going and to apply for grants, and my grants were not accepted. So I ended up, I was collecting patients all this time over 10 years, speaking to patients every Friday and getting their DNA samples to do a genetic study, but I couldn't get funding to do the genetic analysis. And so I then partnered with the personal genetics company, 23andMe, because they had a brilliant model where they were asking their customers to opt into research studies, and then they would ask them questions, and they already had their genetic data so that they could do the same type of analysis that I was trying to do. And they agreed, and they put in questions on hyperemesis in their survey, and it was turned out to be very fruitful. So that was the first study. It was published in 2017, where we were able to show a connection between the gene that codes for this pregnancy hormone and this appetite and nausea and vomiting hormone, GDF15. And then after that, I was able to get my patients that I was unable to get funding for before sequenced by the company Regeneron Genetics Center, and they sequenced my patients and my controls that did not have it. And then we found again that in that case, the only significant risk factor was a mutation in GDF15 and a rare variant and a common and a rare variant we identified, both happened to be in GDF15 in that study. So there's this strong link between that gene and that hormone, which we already know, knew at the time, was involved in another disease called cachexia, which is a disease that even if you haven't heard of, you've seen, I'm sure, where patients die not from their cancer, but from their cachexia. They basically lose their appetite and have severe weight loss and muscle wasting. And in that disease, the cancers are producing a huge amount of the same hormone that the placenta also makes in pregnancy. So similar diseases, but one occurs during pregnancy and one occurs with cancer. So that's where we first found this link. And then for the recent paper that was just published in Nature, we figured out the mechanism.
Talk us through that mechanism now. You found this gene. It produces this hormone, a GDF, or it's responsible for production of GDF15, a mutation here. What then is going wrong?
Yeah, so it was actually really surprising. We expected that what was going wrong in these patients was that the gene was doing something to make the patient have too much of this hormone, because the hormone causes nausea and vomiting. But what we found in this paper actually was that those genetic variants that we had identified, two common and one rare one, all were associated with having lower levels rather than higher levels. So this was really confusing, and I was scratching my head trying to figure out what was going on here. How could something that predisposes you to nausea and vomiting and is a hormone that causes nausea and vomiting be present at lower levels in people with hyperemesis gravidarum and predispose them? And so I partnered with an endocrinologist, Stephen O'Reilly, who's the lead author on the paper, and he is an expert in hormones. And so he had the idea that maybe this hormone acts like other hormones in that it can be desensitized. And so he tested that in mice. This is my favorite part of the paper. And he showed that you could actually desensitize the mice to the hormone, which is a feature of other hormone pathways. So basically, you can, when you give mice a high dose of this hormone, which is similar to the dose that pregnant people get, it causes the mice to stop eat or lower their food intake and lose weight. But if you give them a smaller dose, a little dose of it prior to that, you can desensitize them. So those mice that were given the small dose prior to the high dose, they did not have any appetite loss or weight loss compared to the controls that were not given the priming dose. So then we looked at the reverse, which was looking in humans. We found that in humans there is a condition called thalassemia. And in that condition, patients have lifelong high levels of this hormone. The hormone doesn't only occur during pregnancy. It also is produced at high levels in states where your body is under physical stress. So when you have an infection or a disease, any kind of weakened state, it's sort of the body's way, we think, to signal that you're more likely to survive if you rest and recover rather than go out searching for food, which was probably very useful during our hunter-gathering stage for the survival of our species. But now when driving to the market is not a very risky thing. We don't probably need this anymore, but it still exists. So
we'll pick up that thread in just a moment. We have to take a quick break. We're talking about a condition that causes severe nausea and vomiting during pregnancy with Marlena Fazo from the University of Southern California, a lead researcher on a big finding on the causes of this fairly common condition. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk about the causes of hyperemesis gravidarum, which causes potentially life-threatening nausea and vomiting during pregnancy. Marlena Fazo is with us, lead researcher on a big finding on this condition. She's with the University of Southern California. Let's bring on a caller now. Lisa is with us in St. Paul. Lisa, hi.
Hi, Hi, Dr. Faiso. I just wanted to thank you so much for doing this research. I actually had HG in my pregnancy 14 years ago, and I took part in your study, mailed my samples of saliva and other medical records from St. Paul and took part in one of your early studies. And I just want to thank you so much for everything you've been doing in this area.
Lisa, thanks so much for sharing that. Marlena, people like Lisa have been a big part of your research findings.
Yeah, and I'm so grateful to all the participants. I mean, some of these participants called me from their hospital beds to participate. So, you know, or they have small children or they're pregnant and ill. So I couldn't have done this without them. And I'm really grateful that they participated in the study and we finally got here.
Lisa, thank you so much for sharing that with us. I appreciate it. Now, Marlena, I want to pick up. You mentioned, you know, we've got this finding, this gene that leads to people having this GDF15 hormone that's causing the nausea and vomiting during pregnancy. Now, maybe treatment. You were talking about sort of pre-treating mice to avoid the worst impact. And you were talking about now there are some people who have a higher level of this hormone. What happens then when they get pregnant?
Yeah, so that's the fascinating thing is that those people have either no nausea and vomiting at all, or a few of them had very little levels of nausea and vomiting. So now we can see that it looks like we should be able to prime people with this condition when they want to get pregnant again by increasing their levels of GDF15 prior to pregnancy to decrease their sensitivity to the hormone when it rises rapidly during pregnancy. So hopefully we can test that. So that's one approach to prevent HG by increasing the levels prior to pregnancy. And then during pregnancy, we are looking at approaches to decrease the hormone or block it from binding the receptor during pregnancy to decrease the nausea and vomiting during pregnancy.
Now, I know this is still in early stages, but I'm wondering how this would work. We wouldn't necessarily know until someone's pregnant if they're going to have this. Are you thinking, well, maybe we have a thing where we do a genetic screening? Do you have this mutation? If so, then we try this GDF15. I know it's not exactly inoculation, but preparation?
Yeah, so we're looking into that, and we're not quite there yet because most of the risk variants were identified in people of white European descent. So I'm trying to get funding to look more broadly at the variants so that we can have a genetic screening test that works for everyone. But we also can test people that have had a prior pregnancy. So many people who have hyperemesis decide not to go through pregnancy again because it's such a horrible experience for them and decide to limit their family size. So those people, they contact the HER Foundation all the time, the Hyperemesis Education and Research Foundation, asking if there's anything new out there to prevent them from having it again. So there's a high recurrence risk. And so those people would be the people that we would start the approach with. To see if we can sort out the details with them and get it working well. And then we can try to go into helping more people more broadly, even before they've ever had an experience with HG.
And Marlena, in just our last minute or so, today, if somebody's diagnosed with this hyperemesis during pregnancy, do we have anything in our toolkit to help them out at least a little?
Yeah, so I mentioned the HER Foundation, and I highly recommend people go to hyperemesis.org and check out. They have so many resources and tools for people to share protocols that people can share with their provider. There are medications that can help, IV fluids. There is also, I always say people should take thiamine or vitamin B1 because there is a rare but dangerous side effect that can occur or condition that can occur if you don't have enough vitamin B1. So that's another thing I recommend. But yeah, there's many resources on the website of the HER Foundation. So that's the best place to go, I think, Marlena, and support as well.
Marlena, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing your research with us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Marlena Faso, clinical assistant professor of population and public health sciences in the Center for Genetic Epidemiology at the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. She talked to us about her research on hyperemesis gravidarum, a potentially severe condition a lot of people face during pregnancy, and her big research findings on that. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, a Wisconsin journalist shares her family's long story of dealing with mental illness. We'll meet the author of the new book, While You Were Out. And Rotary, Kiwanis, and other volunteer organizations have played a big role over the years in American civic life, but they've also faced challenges recruiting new members over the decades. We'll dig into the role of these civic organizations and their future. If you are or have been involved with one of those groups, love to hear from you. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, we'll talk with the dean of Boston University's School of Public Health about how he believes leaders in his field need to rebuild public trust after the pandemic. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.